Chapter 1. Through the Gate. After 17 days of headwinds and foggy weather, the Pacific mail ship City of Peking arrived in San Francisco from Yokohama at 3 o'clock on the afternoon of May 28, 1889, carrying 43 Japanese and 24 Chinese in steerage and 52 passengers in cabins. These latter included Sir Guilford Molesworth and Lady Molesworth and their daughter, General A.G. Studer, United States Consul at Singapore, 6 missionaries, 14 Japanese, and Rudyard Kipling. R. Kipling, identified as the traveling correspondent of the Pioneer of Allahabad, Northeast India, also connected with the Civil and Military Gazette of Lahore, was confidently setting out to conquer the English-speaking world and curious to see the Wild West of which he had read so much. Kipling was 23 and a half years old, short, eyeglassed, and sported a heavy mustache he had worn proudly since the age of 12, if we can believe photographs of him with his schoolmates. He was traveling with Professor S. A. Hill and his wife, an admiring young woman slightly older than he was, who had befriended and encouraged him during a study apprenticeship in journalism in the hot and exotic climate of India. Edmonia Hill's description of young Kipling when she first met him in late 1887 is contained in a letter to her sister, published in the Atlantic Monthly of April 1936. "My partner called my attention to a short, dark-haired man of uncertain age with a heavy mustache and wearing very thick glasses who sat opposite, saying, 'This is Rudyard Kipling, who has just come from Lahore to be on the staff of P.I. He is writing those charming sketches of the native states.' Of course I was interested. The author has struck a new vein, and everyone was talking about the information he displayed. Mr. Kipling looks about 40, as he is beginning to be bald, but he is in reality just 22. He was animation itself, telling his stories admirably so that those about him were kept in gales of laughter. He fairly scintillated, but when more sober topics were discussed, he was posted along all lines." She had immediately resolved to ask the young man to have dinner with them at an early date, and the friendship had developed into a strong interdependence. Kipling wrote her sometimes daily when they were separated. It was partly because Edmonia and her husband Alec were returning to visit her family in Pennsylvania that Ruddy decided to journey round the world and try his literary fortunes in England after 7 years of apprenticeship and some little success in India. Kipling had lived as one of the pampered English ruling class in India, had not only enjoyed the comforts of a charming home maintained by his gifted parents — his father was an artist, teacher, museum director — and for a while an apartment in the Hills residence, but had become accustomed to commanding his own small vehicle and his own personal Hindu servant. He was well indoctrinated in the notion of British supremacy and vast empire, an attitude which was to bring honor and imprecations as it extended throughout his life. Kipling had made arrangements with the Hindu pioneer to dispatch a series of travel letters describing his adventures en route. One of his few literary idols had begun a career by a similar device, sending letters back home from abroad to a San Francisco paper. Kipling was to make a point of visiting Mark Twain in Elmira, New York, before he proceeded from America to England. Kipling's letters were full of wry comments and observations, as was to be expected. He was fairly laudatory of Japan, where he and the Hill spent a month sightseeing. Then on the long voyage across the sullen Pacific, when high seas and headwinds got 50 knots off each day's run, and the City of Peking struggled, under-engined, without the optimum assistance of four-master sails customarily used to speed the voyage, Kipling found out how fear should be painted, for the ship was a daisy at rolling. It is perhaps understandable that he was somewhat soured by the time they finally entered the Golden Gate in San Francisco Bay. From his superior stance as a proud British subject, estimating the inferior military resources of a lesser nation, he made what proved to be a reverberant statement. When the city of Pekin steamed through the Golden Gate, I saw with great joy that the blockhouse which guarded the mouth of the finest harbor in the world, sir, could be silenced by two gunboats from Hong Kong with safety, comfort, and dispatch. Thus he dismissed old Fort Point, or Fort Winfield Scott, designed during the Civil War after the model of Fort Sumter. The red brick structure boasted walls 36 feet thick, and decorated the projection of San Francisco Peninsula at the southern side of the Golden Gate, a monstrous and probably useless defense against intruders. Fortunately, no British or other naval threat has ever tested its utility. Kipling wrote that he was immediately besieged by reporters who pumped him exhaustively as he was debarking, overwhelming him by their poignant audacity and their beautiful ignorance. Kipling resented the attention of newsmen during his stay in San Francisco, and perhaps he was also quite flattered. He had just begun to be known in England, partly by reason of earnest efforts of a friend, E.K. Robinson, who had sent copies of departmental ditties to English journals in 1886, and initiated a slowly swelling interest in Kipling there. In America, the young man was naturally less known. Bailey Milford, who later claimed to have been the first American to welcome Kipling to this country, said of him, "None of us had ever heard of Kipling, but he, with a few other Anglo-Indians, had heard of himself, and being a very young writer, he was wondering why the whole world was not ready to rise and hail him. How was I to know that the dark little mustached man with the eyeglasses and the Anglican air of indifference to everything was going to all the trouble of living the life of a distinguished literary personage? As I look back upon that first meeting of Kipling with a Californian who presumably knew how to read and yet had not read him, I can understand his prompt impatience for all things American, and his vast disappointment in the dozen or so lines which I wrote for my paper in celebration of his arrival. In those days, all the important San Francisco newspapers, and there were four or five especially flourishing ones, recorded not only shipping arrivals and departures, but the names of registrants at local hotels. First on every list was the Palace Hotel. This huge rectangular structure, erected in 1875 to cover 2.5 acres, advertised a basement and a sub-basement and 3 interior courts, including a great central court with a circular carriage entrance from Montgomery Street. There were rooms for 1,200 guests, and the most elegant of potted palms, bay windows, and expanses of marble. Kipling was unimpressed by this magnificence. For one thing, he walked from the pier to the hotel and found instructions from passers-by fairly unintelligible. At least he made a good story of it. He was shocked to find that the streets in front of the sumptuous building were paved with rude cobblestones. He was astonished to see a cable car without any visible means of support, which slid stealthily behind me and nearly struck me in the back. And last and most shocking, he came upon a street commotion involving a Chinese gentleman who had been stabbed and was bleeding like a pig, and saw a policeman escorting the wounded man away with no apparent interest in apprehending his attacker. As for the Palace Hotel, he called it a 7-story warren of humanity with 1,000 rooms in it. He was disgusted to observe, in a vast marble-paved hall under the glare of an electric light, 40 or 50 men, many wearing frock coats and top hats, who had been provided with spittoons of infinite capacity and generous gape. Kipling, like Charles Dickens before him, was horrified to find that even gentlemen in America spat on principle, and everywhere, mostly into spittoons conveniently stationed on staircases, in bedrooms, in bars, and in public lobbies. Moreover, the hotel clerk, a resplendent individual wearing diamonds, finally condescended to wait upon him while nonchalantly whistling or humming or picking his teeth, an attitude Kipling judged was intended to impress upon the guest the fact that the clerk was a free man and quite the guest's equal. Kipling felt there was no necessity for this swaggering self-consciousness of freedom. Kipling wrote to the Hindu papers that no man offered to inform him of the customs and means of conveyance or dining in the place. He hunted around and found a bar full of bad saloon pictures where men with their hats on the backs of their head were wolfing food from a counter, a free lunch counter where he discovered in wonder you paid for a drink and got as much as you wanted to eat. A very economical way to subsist, he declared. Still, he was unhappy. The hills had gone on ahead to Pennsylvania, where he was later to join them. Kipling was alone and amazed. 300,000 white men and women gathered in one spot, walking upon real pavements in front of real plate-glass-windowed shops, and talking something that was very different from English. "Think of it," he exclaimed.